Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. No matter where you live in America or what you do or how much you make, at least one every 10 years, you count. And right now, the count is on. The U.S. Constitution mandates that a census of every person in the country be taken once every 10 years. It isn't just for the purpose of discovering how many people are here at any given moment. These numbers are used to determine congressional representation, which is based on population and where people live. It also determines how voting districts are drawn, and if that weren't enough, trillions of dollars are at stake. The federal government distributes about $1.5 trillion per year to hospitals, fire departments, to schools, to road construction projects, and more, all based on the census. Participation is mandated by law, but there are some who are cautious about participating. So this hour, we're going to explore the reasons for this count, the questions you'll be answering, how that information will be used, how secure the census is, and what all this will mean to you and our local area. Dina DiOrio is Mecklenburg County Manager and the chair of the Mecklenburg County Complete Count Committee, which is focused on getting us all to participate, particularly traditionally hard-to-count populations. Welcome back. We have other guests standing in the wings to talk about the census. But before we meet them, we need to talk about the coronavirus. And you're the point person here in the county on that, aside from Gibby Harris, who is the health director. Give us an update on where we stand, because I asked you this morning, just before we went on the air, I read in the paper this morning, the number is 11 cases in Mecklenburg County. That's no longer true.
No, we are up to 14 now. We had three new cases, positive cases overnight. You know, we'll see where we go, but obviously that was not unexpected.
And I'm told that we are not too terribly far from asking people to shelter in place, as they are being asked to do in many places in California, including San Francisco. How far away, when did that come up as a possibility?
That came up yesterday as a possibility as we got some test results back where we thought we might be on the cusp of community spread. Mm-hmm. And once you get to that place, we really need to ramp down on mitigation efforts. And, of course, shelter in place is one of those. And, you know, Gibby, as our health director, will ultimately make that decision. But we are in constant conversation about when we might need to do that.
What triggers that?
I think a significant spike in cases would be something that would trigger that for sure.
And 11 to 14 overnight is not a significant spike?
I do think it's significant based on the numbers, and so we will have that conversation later today. I'll also tell you that we are having daily conversations with the CEOs of both of our hospital systems because we think it's important that they be involved in those conversations and help us craft that decision.
What does it mean, and what will it mean if we have to do this, to shelter in place? What does that mean?
Well, what it means is that people would be required to stay home and either work from home or stay home if they can't work from home for some period of time until we see the spike of cases start to level off.
And this is a decision that will be made at the local level. It will not be made at the state level. It'll be made here in Mecklenburg County.
It is my understanding that our health director has the authority to make that decision, but of course we will double check that before we actually move forward.
So there are two words that float around, and we had the assistant director of Medic on the program on Monday who made the distinction between isolation, which is sheltering in place, and quarantine. Isolation is for healthy people. Is that correct?
And incorrect.
Oh, incorrect.
That's
okay.
Incorrect.
So, set me straight, please.
Okay, so quarantine is for people who may have been exposed to somebody who maybe have the virus. Isolation is for people who actually have tested positive and need to be away from other people.
So I got it completely wrong, completely
just
in reverse.
Backwards.
Okay. Will there be exemptions for people who have to leave the house? How does it work?
Well, we know that our healthcare providers and our first responders do not have the luxury of sheltering in place. And so we would obviously there would have to be an exemption for those folks as well. But we have not worked through all those details. In the event we have to do that, those are some of the things that we would have to talk about. So we also know that grocery stores would be allowed to remain open. So there would be exemptions for that as well.
Yesterday, the governor closed all the restaurants and bars. In parts of this country, and I think California among them, they have rationed the number of people who can go into a grocery store at any given time, which has led to lines around grocery stores as people wait to get in. Are we looking at that?
To be determined. We're not really sure. The other thing I wanted to say was that our order, the health director's order, was modified last night to now include closures of all gyms, health spas, and movie theaters. So that I don't know that that got into the public domain.
I'm really surprised that movie theaters stayed open as long as they did, given that anything that over 100 people was illegal, and a lot of movie theaters can accommodate 100 people. Why did it take so long to shut them down?
Because we wanted to wait to see. We're really following the epidemiology on the ground. And when we started to see the spike in cases yesterday, that's when the health director determined that needed to take place.
Is the worst outbreak in North Carolina still in the Wake County area?
As far as we know, it is, yes.
How many tests have been done in Mecklenburg County? I know that one of the county commissioners would like this to be the most tested area in the state, but that's probably not happening yet. Where are we with that?
So far, we have tested over 500 people. As the health director indicated yesterday, we are seeing the number of tests go up. We are seeing the capacity to test go up. And at this point, we have tested all the people that need to be tested. That doesn't mean that all the people that want to be tested have been tested, but we are seeing the capacity for
testing
go up.
How is that determined, all the people who need to be tested?
If you're exhibiting symptoms.
And those symptoms are?
Shortness of breath, fever, and cough.
Okay. Do we have enough tests? Because nobody seems to have enough tests anywhere in the country.
We all need more tests. I think that's obvious.
How many tests do we have available? If we needed to test right now, how many do we have?
I do not know. Because
does Gibby know? Gibby Harris know?
I don't know that we know how many tests the hospitals have, so I don't think we know exactly the number of tests that are available.
The other concern around the country has been the need for ventilators. I'm not exactly sure what that is, because I've never had to have one, thank God, but... we have a shortage of ventilators, and if this goes to become one of the reasons that we are taking all these extraordinary precautions is to lower the spike in the number of cases and spread it out maybe longer but not quite as severe so that hospitals can handle this. And we don't have enough ventilators. How many ventilators are there at Novant and Atrium and other area hospitals? Do we know?
I do not know the answer to that. We can certainly try to get that information and report back.
Have the hospitals expressed to you or to Gibby Harris any concern about being able to handle an influx of patients who need or do not need ventilators? Do they have enough beds?
They have not indicated an issue right now, but one of the things that we know that yesterday they have started to defer all elective surgeries to be able to make sure that they have capacity in their facilities to be able to handle an influx of patients if need be.
Are you and the hospital systems and our health department dealing just with the state level, or are you dealing with the federal government on this?
We are working primarily with the state government, and we know that the state government is really working with the federal government. So we are working with our state partners, getting the guidance from the state, which I think is based on what's happening at the federal level.
We're hoping, of course, that this has not become the problem that it's become in other places like New Rochelle in New York, but it may, and we're taking the precautions to see to it that it doesn't. And once again, I want to get back to the hospitals. If hospitals become swamped, has there been any talk of taking these empty schools and turning them into hospitals, or commandeering hotel rooms, which are empty also, and turning them into hospital rooms?
Not at this time. I will tell you that the county is in negotiations with some local hotels to have rooms available, particularly for homeless residents that need to be either isolated or quarantined and can't do so at a homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. We're also working to obtain hotel rooms to be able to practice social distancing at our homeless shelter so that we can reduce the number of people who are in those facilities to be able to make sure that we're doing what we can to mitigate the spread in that population. But there has not been a conversation around using hotels or schools as makeshift hospitals.
This is what professionals in government do, and you're a professional in government. You're the county manager, and you were, I think, a county manager before you came here, or a city manager before you came here years ago. Is there a dress rehearsal for something like this, or are you making a lot of this up on the fly, or just taking your cues from health professionals elsewhere?
I don't think anybody has a dress rehearsal for something like this. And so we are following the guidance that we're getting from the federal and state government. We're closely following the epidemiology on the ground. We are talking to the healthcare systems and getting their best guidance and what they've seen across the world in terms of how to deal with this. And it's all about communication, collaboration, and being able to make decisions at a moment's notice, which is what we're doing on a day-to-day basis.
So small businesses around the country are going to be critically wounded, perhaps mortally wounded in some cases, as the shutdowns continue, because they're not set up to take in no revenue for months at a time. The restaurant industry is a $40 billion a year industry nationwide, and it employs 14 million people, and that's just one industry. And the government is trying to step up, the federal government is trying to step up and put some assistance in place. At this point in time, it hasn't happened, and it doesn't seem to be sufficient. So is the county doing anything for small business owners or for the employees of these small businesses who cannot go to work and will not get paid as a result?
So the county, the Board of County Commissioners last night appropriated $1.3 million to the Critical Needs Response Fund that is being put together by Foundation for the Carolinas and the United Way of Central Carolinas. And that will be, for now, the primary avenue for us to be able to assist folks in this county that need assistance. But other than that, we haven't made any other financial commitments.
They closed Macy's. They closed Nordstrom's. The Microsoft and Apple and Nike stores have closed. I'm sure that it's just a matter of time before everything in shopping malls will be closed. Bars and restaurants are closed except for takeout. So if I'm a restaurant, if I'm a waiter in a restaurant, if I'm a bartender, if I'm a shoe salesman at South Park, how do I get help from you?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is we need to look at the changes that the governor has made around accessing unemployment benefits. So unemployment benefits will be easier to access and expanded, and so I think that would be our first step.
And you can do it by phone, I'm told?
That's my understanding. Mm-hmm. And so I think that will be a great benefit. We want to see what the federal government does, and I'm sure that we will make our services available to folks who need it in terms of food and nutrition services and other programs that we have that we'll be able to make available to people who need them. But it's going to have to be a collective effort in terms of how we stabilize or try to stabilize our economy here in Mecklenburg County.
How concerned are you about how long this might go on? How long do you think it might go on?
I don't know how long it will go on. I think that the 2 weeks that we're sort of talking about right now, I don't think that will be enough. I think that will likely
That's
be
a fairy
extended.
Tale.
I think it's Yeah, I do. I think it will definitely last longer than that. Of course, I'm worried. I'm worried like everybody else is worried. I'm worried about the health and safety of our community. I'm worried about our local economy. I mean, there's a whole host of things for us to be concerned about.
Because at first, people were talking about, we're going to take these precautions until March 31st. And now it's clear that they will go on into April, into May. And I heard last night from people at the national level, just watching as much television as I could flip around and consume about this, that this could go on for 7 or 8 months. Are we equipped to handle something like that, where we have a complete shutdown of society as we know it for 7 or 8 months?
I don't even know what that looks like. But probably not. We'd have to sort of really take stock of what we need to do. I can tell you from a county perspective, we have considerable reserves. So we would continue to be able to provide services to this community, and we feel very comfortable about that. But this is unprecedented. I don't think any of us really know what the implication of that is.
And do you think people are cooperating? Will it be difficult to enforce a stay-at-home if it comes to that?
I don't think so. I think we're already seeing a lot of voluntary compliance. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think so. I think people are really taking this seriously, and I think people are going to do what they need to do to protect themselves and the community.
Dina DiIorio is not only the county manager, Mecklenburg County manager, but she's also the Mecklenburg County Complete Count Committee chair. And that is the committee that is helping us to make sure that people take and fill out their census forms, which is why you're actually here this morning. And when we come back from the break, we will be joined by two other folks who are involved in the census and you to talk more about why this is important at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mecklenburg County Manager Dina DiOrio is with us. She is also the chair of the Mecklenburg County Complete Count Committee, which is focusing on the 2020 census. And we're also joined now by Lizette Escobedo. She is the National Census Director for the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials Education Fund, which facilitates full Latino participation in the American political process. And she joins us from her self-isolated, sequestered home in Whittier, California. Good morning. Thank you for being here so early in the morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brendan Shanahan is a postdoctoral associate, an historian, actually, at Yale University and scholar of U.S. immigration and citizenship history, who recently published an article in the Washington Post and headlined, "Counting Everyone, Citizens and Non-Citizens, in the 2020 Census is Crucial." Brendan joins us from somewhere near New Haven, Connecticut this morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So the last time we talked about the census on this program, obviously, was 2000. And when we did so, we talked to people from the Census Bureau in Washington, D.C. And this time we're taking a little different approach. The 2020 census and all the previous censuses, and that's the I looked it up. I thought it might be census, but all the previous censuses were more than a head count. But they were a way to use data and distribute money and representation on various political bodies. So, Dina, in addition to being the county manager, you're the chair of this Complete Count Committee, which includes County Commission Chairman George Dunlap and Mayor Vi Lyles. Why do we have this committee? Why do we need local people to push a federal census?
Because we know that the most effective way to get people to fill out their census form is really to do it at a grassroots level, because people want to hear from trusted voices in the community about why it's important and why it affects them. And so the more we can do on the local level, the more success we'll have in getting a complete count.
And do all local areas around the country have committees like yours doing this?
I can't speak for the whole country. I will tell you that we had a representative from the Census Bureau come around probably got to be at least a year and a half ago, and she went and visited every county manager in the state of North Carolina and asked every county manager to establish a complete count committee.
Okay. Since we are a rapidly growing area, the Charlotte region, I would imagine that this head count, this census, is all that much more important to us and to individuals living here. Would that be accurate?
Absolutely.
Do you think people understand that?
I can't really say people understand it, but we've spent a lot of time over the last several months really trying to educate this community about why it is important.
Well, let's talk about that. What is the bottom line monetarily? How much more money would come into the county and to county coffers and to the state if we get an accurate headcount that is actually reflective of the enormous growth that we have experienced here?
Well, we know that in 2016, the state of North Carolina got $24 billion from the federal government based on census data. And that comes to local governments for things like education and transportation, healthcare, other kinds of programs. And so the more of a complete count we get, the more money will come to this community.
And one of the things that your committee here is focused on is traditionally hard, traditionally hard to count populations that you're encouraging to participate. What is being done to locate them, first of all? And secondly, what is being done to encourage them to participate?
So we have data by census tract, which shows us where our historically underrepresented census tracts are. And so what we're doing is we're doing a lot of outreach and a lot of grassroots work with people in those communities to get them to talk to folks about the importance of census.
So, Brendan, I received two notices in the mail about participating in this census, and both notices gave me a personal code to use in filling out the census online. Is that going to be the approach with everyone in the entire country, or are there still going to be census workers knocking on your door?
Great question. So the move towards digitization is certainly picking up a pace, and the goal is to try to use that system to get as many people to enter their information as soon as possible. The sooner the better. However, the Census Bureau will still be employing folks to go out to do exactly what Dina was saying, to reach every community and try to get as accurate a count as possible.
How How impactful are you fearful that the coronavirus outbreak will be on census takers' ability to knock on people's doors?
I am concerned. We know that there's always undercounts in enumerations like the census. And given the incredible situation that we're in right now, particularly the disruption of where people are at this very moment, college students being at their homes as opposed to being at colleges and universities, this is an unprecedented development. Every 10 years, there's a new curveball along the way, and certainly 1920, 100 years ago, the aftermath of World War I and the Spanish flu was a particular challenge. But I think right now, this is unprecedented on an even larger scale.
So would it be correct to say that college students living in dorms would have gotten their notification from the Census Bureau with their special code to do it online, that they would have gotten that piece of mail at their university or college? And if they're living at home now, that mail may be late in arriving or not arrive at all?
To be honest, I can't speak specifically to that. And perhaps one of our other guests is more would be able to answer your question there. But I do know that that is one of the concerns that folks that I've been reading about in the census community have flagged as an issue of a particular challenge.
What about people who don't have access to internet, Dina?
Well, that's definitely one of the concerns. I mean, we are pushing people to fill the census out online because we think it's obviously the most effective way to do that. People can also fill it out by phone. They can call and do it by phone. So that's another option for folks. And if they do want a paper questionnaire, they can request one. One of the impacts of the coronavirus is that we were planning to do a number of outreach events at our libraries and other places to have people who don't have internet access to be able to do their census questionnaire at those locations.
And the libraries are closed.
Obviously, that's not going to happen.
We got an email yesterday from a longtime listener, Ted, who says, I noted a possible problem when I completed my census form last night. I filled out my census form using an up-to-date Mac laptop and an up-to-date Safari browser. It took 8 minutes to fill out the form, but then I could not submit the form on the Safari browser. I switched over to Chrome, had to fill out the form again, only took 4 minutes this time, and it worked perfectly. Could be my computer or operator error, but not being able to use Safari, not being warned about using Safari was a bit of a turnoff. And he said, I have received 3 notices via the United States Post Office. 1 would be sufficient. The extra 2 notices are a waste of resources, labor, postage, paper, and more importantly, my taxes. Lizette, the census is a complete, allegedly, as complete a count of every person in the country as we can possibly achieve. That means that citizens and non-citizens, including those who may not have come here through channels, are to be counted. And given the current administration's stance on immigrants and on immigration, that has a lot of people in the Latino community nervous, to put it mildly. Do people in that community understand that by law, the answers given in the census cannot be shared with anyone for 72 years? And if they do know it, do they believe it?
So I think part of our work is letting them know this, right? So some of the research that we recently did in 2019, out of it was about 1,600 Latinos that we surveyed across the country, 50% of them were expecting a citizenship question on their form. And although most of them had generally positive views of the census and understood the importance of the census, they were still fearful. And so one of the things that we know is we need to reassure them that their information is private, safe, and secure, 1. 2, we need to make sure that this message comes from trusted messengers in the community. So another thing that we learned through our research is that Latino organizations tend to be trusted messengers for most Latinos. So it kind of needs the seal of approval of an ALEO, of a MALDEF, to make sure that they understand that when we say their information is private, safe, and secure through Title 13, that we mean it and that we back it, right? And then a quick just correction that I did want to make is that folks actually can't call the Bureau to request a paper form, but everybody will get a paper form starting April 8th. And then really quickly for college students, they will get counted through what's known as group quarter enumeration, which means that the Bureau contacts the administration of the college campuses to make sure that they're either counted electronically through paper, and those through paper might be shifted to electronically. So all of that is done through the campus, but college students should still be counted where they were planning to be on April 1st, which more than likely was on campus for many of them.
And in our community, Dina, do we have people in the Latino community, respected, trusted leaders going out to that community and encouraging them to fill out these census forms?
We absolutely do. We have a series of subcommittees that include representation from all demographics that are really working with our Latino community. We also have a partnership with Telemundo, and they'll be doing some targeted media outreach and advertising to the Latino population.
Lizette, you referenced this citizenship question. President Trump wanted to add a citizenship question to the census. There was a citizenship question on the census a long, long time ago, like 75 years ago, and it was taken out. And once again, the president lost that battle. There will not be a citizenship question on the census. Is that word spreading through the Latino community?
Here's the interesting thing. It's spreading more so across immigrant Latino communities. One of the things that we've seen is that when we broke down the numbers for our survey, Latino immigrants were more informed, not only around the citizenship question, but also on the census itself. And millennials were the least informed. It's making its waves through Spanish language media, and I think what we saw throughout a lot of our research was that a lot of your Spanish dominant Latinos were a little bit more informed, and we do again credit that to the work. I know folks mentioned doing local work with Telemundo. All of that has made significant impact in our community, so we need to continue to do a lot of that. But one of our challenges right now is reaching Latino millennials where they're at, who many of them are English dominant. Many of them don't consume Spanish language media. And so at NALEO, we're hard at work to figure out how do we reach Latino millennials through English content that is culturally relevant. We're doing what we can. We have a lot of work ahead of us at the local and national level.
You're here, Brendan, partly as an historian, and you've done a lot of research on the history of the census, which began at the very beginnings of the country, and you've also written extensively about this citizenship question. You point out that, this is a quote from you, discovery of Republican redistricting expert Thomas Hoffler's files exposed the administration's real reasoning to want to have this citizenship question, to make possible redistricting and reapportionment schemes advantageous to Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. Now, Mr. Hoffler, his secret files are famous here in North Carolina because they played into legislative reapportionment here in North Carolina, so they were struck down after these files were discovered. But you say that although the Trump administration has been prevented by the courts from asking this citizenship question on the census, Mr. Trump's Justice Department is still trying to use the roadmap left by Hoffler on future court battles involving reapportionment of state legislators. Talk about that.
Great question. So I think there can be a bit of a misconception between how the rules of federal reapportionment and redistricting work and then state legislative redistricting and apportionment. And so while the federal constitution is explicit that everyone must be counted for the and included in the population when it comes to reapportionment and the number of seats each state is assigned for the federal House of Representatives, historically, state legislatures have had a more varied approach to quite literally who counts for the purposes of apportionment and redistricting and the way in which those metrics are designed. In the past, often northeastern states, Massachusetts, Maine, New York, created provisions which counted non-citizens out of state legislative apportionment provisions. And more recently, the discovery of the Hoffler files, in addition to other reporting, suggests that there are attempts to do these types of counting non-citizens out of the population at the state legislative apportionment and redistricting level. Mm. And in particular, there's also an effort at the federal level, though given the history of jurisprudence, I don't see that working. Okay. But I think there's a bigger battle brewing at the state legislative level.
To remind people that we only know about these Hoffler files because Professor Hoffler or Mr. Hoffler died and left a computer behind, and his daughter found the files and turned them over. Let the cat out of the bag. I filled out my census form over the weekend online, like our like Ted, our listener, did, and it was very quick. They weren't many questions. Maybe 5 or 10 minutes is what it took. They wanted to know my race, gender, who was living in the house, my relationship with anybody living in the house. Very little else. I suppose that's the short version, because I have filled out much longer censuses in my life. What kinds of questions are they asking in the long version, Dina?
So there's not a long form.
There's
in
not.
This census.
This is it?
This is it, because the American Community Survey, and I'm sure that my colleagues on the show can help with this, but the American Community Survey is now the vehicle being used to collect that more extensive information.
Okay, because on this form, they ask you how many people were living or staying in this house, apartment, or mobile home on April 1st, 2020. But I filled it out last weekend, so how am I supposed to know that? That's the future.
Well, I think the whole point is that the count is supposed to reflect how many people are living in the United States on April 1st.
They also wanted to know, were there any additional people staying here on April 1st that you did not include in question one? Why would they need to know that? It could be a visitor, it could be your grandma from out of state, could be anybody, right?
It could be, but I think, again, it's making sure that we get the most accurate count that we can on April 1st.
Then they want to know what kind of a dwelling it is. Is it a house? Is it an apartment? Is it a mobile home? Do you own it? Do you rent it? What's your telephone number? How scary is that, Lizette, for some people?
It is a little scary, especially for a lot of, our undocumented immigrant community. But this is, again, why education and information is so important. So we've been doing a lot of work over the course of the past couple of months. We've trained about 3,500 census ambassadors across the country. This is a five-hour training that we put them through. As a census nerd, it fills my nerd heart. But we wanted to make sure that all of our leaders understood how important each of these little boxes was.
Let me stop you there because we got to take a break. We're coming back with more, and I'll let you finish that question in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
How has your life changed since the outbreak of the coronavirus? Are you interacting with your neighbors differently as social distancing is encouraged? Are you working from home for the first time? Or are you even in a position to do so? Are you taking a financial hit because of the virus? As supplies have run low at grocery stores, what have you done to feel prepared? WFAE wants to hear from you. Share your story by leaving us a voicemail at 704-916-9114.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the census with Dina DiIorio, Mecklenburg County's manager, but also the chair of the Mecklenburg County Complete Count Committee. She's in our studio. Brendan Shanahan is in near Yale this morning in New Haven, where he's an historian and an expert on U.S. immigration and citizenship history. And Lizette Escobedo is the National Census Director of the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials Education Fund. She joins us from California. I had to interrupt you in the middle of an answer about how troubling it might be to some parts of our population, particularly hard to reach people and Latinos who are suspicious, perhaps with justification, of questions being asked of them by the federal government about how they feel about being asked about their telephone number and about who's in the house with them and what their names are and what your relationship to that person is. How are their fears being allayed?
So a lot of this work has been around education information. So there's a couple of things that folks should know, right, about some of the questions that are asked. For example, telephone number is asked because this is in the event that the Bureau needs to follow up with a household to request more information. Maybe there's missing information. Right now, that becomes extremely critical because it may be there may be a point during the non-response follow-up phase where a lot of the follow-up may be conducted more so via phone than in person, depending on how all of this, you know, this madness goes. And then for names, we inform people that the best way to figure out if there's any duplicates on the form or if you've counted a person more than once on your form is to compare names, to compare birthdays, and to compare ages. So again, a lot of this information is either to make sure that there are no duplicates or to make sure, for example, they ask birthday and age, because when we talk about those programs, like nutritional programs for kids, educational programs for kids, they need to know the age of the people that are in the community. So we've done a lot of work to really educate the community on what each box means, what each question means. Still more work to be done, like I mentioned initially, and a lot of it has, in the field, has somewhat come to a standstill, but we're looking to do that digitally as well.
So they will be asking, Brendan, on this they will not be asking whether you're a citizen of the United States on this census, despite President Trump's desire to put that question on there. They will not be asking that question. But there's also this law that keeps whatever data they collect in this census secret for 72 years, which is an average lifetime. So when your information comes out, you will probably not be alive. But you write that President Trump has issued an executive order requiring federal departments to share citizenship data in their possession with the Commerce Department as a means of working around the court's rejection of the citizenship question on the census. Wouldn't that be against the law?
There is ongoing litigation about all of these matters for very good reason. However, the Trump administration, it feels like a lifetime ago, but it was last June and July when this citizenship question was, you know, the front page news of our newspapers for several weeks. The reason why the Supreme Court struck down the citizenship question, rather surprisingly, was the discovery of the Hoffler files, in which Chief Justice Roberts was the swing vote, saying essentially the rationale provided before the court wasn't reflective of what the documents demonstrated. And the Trump administration, for a little while, tried to persist even after that defeat. And instead, afterwards, President Trump issued an executive order with Attorney General Barr, if I recall correctly, outside the White House, ordering essentially various departments to try to send citizenship data in their possession to essentially the Commerce Department and through them, the Census Bureau, in their eyes, to essentially come up with a sense of citizenship data of the nation's population. Advocates are worried that this is going to be highly, you know, inaccurate and an incomplete snapshot, with good reason.
Yeah. So given the fact that he's initiated this executive order and federal departments are supposed to comply, and given the fact that the 72-year rule was actually violated, I think, during World War II.
Put in place
after World War II because of the census data being used to quarantine Japanese Americans, should people who are concerned about their status be filling out the census?
Sorry, was that a question to me?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
People should absolutely be filling out the census. It's so important for precisely the reasons that that everyone here has been discussing today, for redistricting for the purposes of allocation of funds, as a civic duty. I think it's imperative for the broader community to do precisely the education. That we've been talking about, and to push back when there are attempts to invade people's privacy. But the census itself and an accurate count is absolutely essential for representative democracy.
So let's talk about what this means to Mecklenburg County, Dina, because an accurate count in Mecklenburg County, given the enormous growth that we have experienced in the last 10 years, really means dollars and cents. How much money is it at stake here for Mecklenburg County?
Well, I mean, we have several estimates, but, you know, we believe that, you know, for people that for the number of people who don't complete the census, it could cost us about $2,200 per person per year.
And that money goes to what? Education,
roads, it goes to all of our block grant programs, child care, community development block grant programs. It goes for transportation, for health care, a lot of programs that we value in this community.
And it goes to congressional representation and how district voting districts for legislative voting districts and congressional voting districts are drawn. And as we grow, one would presume that citizens would want our political power to grow and be reflected in the number of representatives we have in Congress, which is determined by the census, right?
Yes.
We have a 1 in 10 year shot at this.
Yes.
Lizette, Latinos are set to become the largest majority or minority in the United States in short order. So with that in mind, just how important is Latino participation in this survey? What could an accurate count of the Latino population in the United States mean to that community?
Well, you're perfectly correct. Latinos are now the second largest population group in the country. You know, one of the largest voting blocks in the country as well. So we know that as Latinos move, the country moves, right? We're no longer just in California, in Florida, and in New York. We are in North Carolina. We are in Arkansas. And so ensuring that we have a full count of the Latino community is ensuring we have a full count of every single community. And so it's extremely important that folks dedicate efforts to make sure that this community is informed, is educated, understand what is in the census, understand who is counted. So again, making sure that we have a full count of Latinos, it should be a priority for all communities because we live, work, and sleep in all communities across the country.
There are portions of the Latino community in isolated areas in the United States who do not speak English. And this is true, I think, of other populations other than Latinos. And gosh knows, how many languages are spoken by students at Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools? It's an enormous
number.
It's in the hundreds.
It is.
It's in the hundreds. So how are those people being reached if they don't speak English well? How are they being reached, Lizette?
So for folks who are Spanish speakers only, I will share that the Census Bureau has allocated a significant amount of money to various ads across the country. To make sure that they're reaching them. In addition to that, again, we've been working with our Spanish language media partners, both at the national and local level, for quite some time now. But there are additional communities. You know, you do have your API community who have a significant amount of languages as well. And so something to note is that while the paper form may only come in two languages and the online form and the telephone questionnaire is in 13 languages, there are 59 languages that the Census Bureau has language glossaries and language ID cards for. And so they will be reaching a huge amount of the community. But again, aside from the ads, aside from the efforts that, you know, organizations like Naleo are doing, we're actually investing in a comprehensive radio ad buy campaign and digital ad buy campaign with partners at United We Dream, FIRM. So there's a lot of work being done to reach them, but what I would, my call to action here for any folks tuning in is that when in doubt, just make sure to reach out to your local community and invite them to participate in the census as well, because it is going to take all of us to count, not just Latinos, but all of the community in general.
So a couple of listener questions. Evan on Facebook, and I'll let you take this one, Dina. Is there a difference between mycensus2020.gov and census2020.gov? Why are there two websites?
Well, the mycensus2020.gov is the one where you need to go to complete your questionnaire.
Okay.
The other one is the General Census Bureau website, which provides all the information about the census.
Chuck emails, when should I be concerned if I haven't received a census notification in the mail, and what should I do if I don't get one?
So you don't need your code on the letter to fill out the census. The code is really just helpful to facilitate the completion of the questionnaire. So if you don't get your letter in the mail, you can still complete the census online.
Because if you put the code in, your address pops up.
Correct.
As an identifier. Correct. But if you don't get one, you can just start from ground zero and put your address in.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Paul on Facebook, we close on our new home on March 30th. Which address do we use for the census? Our physical move will be mid-April. Anybody want an answer to that question?
It's where you're physically living on April 1st.
So if you're living in a motel temporarily, that's what you put? Do you put the motel's address? Because some people do that. They live in an apartment or a motel between moves, between houses.
I'm going to see if one of my other one of my other colleagues can answer that. I don't want to misspeak here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anybody know?
So this is Lisa. So usually it'll be at the old home for a couple of reasons, because more than likely they'll have received the form or the letter invitation before they moved out. And so it's perfectly okay to fill out the form on behalf of that household, again, because that's where they potentially receive the form. If they're already at a new location, right, of somewhere they're going to be living on April 1st and beyond, then they can fill it out there. But it'll more than likely be at their wherever they receive their invitation, because remember, the invitation comes to it comes by address, by household. It doesn't come in the name of a specific person in the household.
So Tom emails, I just completed the census 2 days ago. When I entered the email address on my Android phone on a Firefox browser, I got a blank screen. When I called the number, the automated system could not get my ID number correct. A human ended up answering, and the whole call took just under 20 minutes. Ah, technology, it's a wonderful thing. But this census started long before technology. And Brendan, you're the historian here. And I know that you've looked into how this has been conducted over the years. And I don't think people know that technology actually emerged as a result of this census in the 1890 census. That's when punch cards became a thing to help with tabulation. And in fact, an electric tabulation machine was invented by the same guy who invented the punch cards, which went on to become a company that he formed that merged with many other companies and became IBM.
IBM. Right. The census is one of the largest operations that the federal government does, you know, ever, particularly civilian operations of the federal government. And it's an activity that has spurred on many types of social scientific methodology discoveries, technological advancements. It is a massive, massive operation, and it in turn has transformed the way in which technology and research is done in the U.S. And across the world.
These census counts go back to the beginning of humanity. They go back to ancient China, well before Jesus, and of course, if you look at the New Testament, the reason Mary and Joseph are going to Bethlehem is to participate in the census. And that census was to help Caesar Augustus collect taxes. This census, Dina, helps us get some of our tax money back. Is that right?
That's right. We've come full circle.
So again, who does the government want you to include in your answers on this census form?
Anybody who's living in your household.
Anybody.
Anybody.
On April,
everybody.
On April the 1st.
Correct.
Okay, before we go, one more thing, and that's going back to this coronavirus situation. We now have 14, at least when we started the program.
Correct.
We had 14 confirmed cases in Mecklenburg County. And we are on the cusp of deciding about whether a shelter-in-place order, not unlike what other communities around the country have instituted, may be put into effect. Who makes that decision? When will that decision be made?
So the public health director, I believe, has the authority to make that decision, and we will double check that just to be sure. We don't know when the decision will be made. We continue to evaluate again the epidemiology on the ground, and we will consult with other experts, including our hospital systems, the State Department of Health and Human Services, to determine when that should be made.
All right. Dina DiOrio is Mecklenburg County Manager. She's the chair of the Mecklenburg County Complete Count Committee, and their message to you is very simple. fill out the census. Get on with it. It really is quick. Lizette Escobedo is the National Census Director of the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials Education Fund, and she joined us from self-quarantine isolation in Whittier, California. Brendan Shanahan, an historian and an expert on U.S. immigration and citizenship history, joined us from New Haven, Connecticut, where he is at Yale University. Thank you all for the hour, and stay healthy. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.